You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. If you missed the first hour tonight, folks, you missed one of the most important episodes that we have ever put out to you as far as information on that can be useful to you at some point in the future, probably. And I want to tell you that we're not going to repeat that hour. In this hour, we're not going to do any kind of a recap. We covered the ammunition of the 375 H&H Magnum. We covered how to convert that 375 H&H Magnum around to an improved 375 H&H Magnum. We talked about the action. We talked about all kinds of things. In other words, we're building the ultimate sniper rifle that could be used by militiamen or patriots in this country in case this country were ever invaded and occupied by a foreign power or maybe even a friendly power, so-called, that wanted to oppress the American people. So we're going to continue in this hour with that, but first, got to read you a little news bulletin here, hot off the Associated Press. Portland, Oregon. Former presidential candidate James Bogrites, Bobo Grits to everybody around here, is establishing a center for white supremacists in central Idaho, a human rights group said Friday. Grites and some ultra-conservative Christian leaders have purchased about 280 acres of land near Kamaya, Idaho, according to a report issued by the Coalition of Human Dignity. Boy, you folks have bit into the sour apple. You've fallen for the scam, and believe me, hate to say it, but you're going to pay for it. Grites is a Trojan horse. I've made that statement many times. I've proved on this program that he is a liar, and many other things. In his own words, ladies and gentlemen, not just because I say so, but in his own words. We had a guest on this program who told you about Grites' real role in drugs coming into this country and the scam trial on phony passport charges in Nevada, where he was tried in the wrong venue, and the prosecutors knew it. And Grites went around the country saying he was acquitted by the jury because he was charged with the wrong charges, and that's not true. The case was dismissed because it was the wrong venue. Every time we investigate this guy, turns out that he's lied again and again and again and again and again. And his religion changes according to the religion of whatever audience he's talking to. So all you people up there in Idaho, you better wake your stupid butts up, or you're going to find yourself behind barbed wire. And Grites is going to be outside holding the keys, laughing. Don't like it? That's tough. And things are going to get a lot tougher. Too many sheeple in this country. Too much apathy. Too much ignorancy. Ignorancy? Did I just invent a word? Too much ignorance? And way, way too much stupidity. You want to take this country back? You want to maintain your freedom? Well, I say unless you wise up and get smart, you're just going to go from one form of slavery to another. Good evening, folks. I hope you're ready for probably, well, it's got to be the second best program, or the second most important, or one of the second most important programs we've ever done. The first half was earlier this evening, and we're building the ultimate sniper rifle. Legally and lawfully. And we talked about why you can't build exactly what John, our guest, has built, which is probably the best long-range sniper rifle that's ever been built in the history of the world, in my estimation, and the estimation of many other people also. John, of course, is not his real name, nor will we give you his real name, but he has been teaching the listeners of this broadcast how to use what's available to build their own ultimate long-range sniper rifle. And we've covered about half of the weapon so far. We've covered the ammunition. We've covered the action. We've talked about why we chose that action. We talked about how this whole project got started. And now we're going to continue, and we're going to go from the action to the barrel. But I think you wanted to make one comment about probably the worst action to get, or the one that the extractor is most prone to failure. Just put it that way.
Yes, Bill, I did. I'd like to interject this before we get sidetracked and I lose the point entirely. I might mention that every privately owned typical deer rifle, in other words, bolt action sporter out there in private possession now, probably possesses the potential of at least a 100% increase in its accuracy and overall performance capability in the existing chambering or cartridge for which it's chambered now, as is, with a few key point type modifications or improvements. As we discussed in the first hour, one of the prime considerations in the selection of a bolt action, specifically for field use as we've discussed so far, is the properties possessed in the form of its extraction system. And this is what sets the Mauser system far and away above most other available conventional bolt actions. Now, by the same token, one of the least desirable actions for that very reason available on the market, in other words, one of the least useful for our purposes, would be anything in the Remington system, most prevalently the Model 700 Remington, simply because the weak link in the chain in the design system is its extractor. It's the most prone to failure, the most prone to breakage, etc. This equipment has to be capable of sustained use under adverse field conditions, and if it is not capable of that, so happens, the shame of it is, the Remington action is one of the potentially most accurate actions ever designed thus far in the history of small arms. By the same token, the detracting factor involved here is simply an extractor prone to failure. So, having made that point, we'll move right along into the barrel part of the system known as the 375 Improved Magnum Long Range Rifle. There are two primary manufacturers of barrels out there today, widely recognized for their quality as well as durability, but mainly their high precision accuracy, one of which is Douglas, which produces an international match grade air gauge, perfectly satisfactory for this type of application. My own personal preference runs along the lines of the Schillen brand barrel out of Texas in the international match grade.
Mm-hmm.
I might add Chromoly alloy, which is your carbon steel, tool steel variant, as opposed to stainless. I've never been a stainless steel fan, particularly in high velocity center fire rifle applications. Stainless steel is comparatively soft and gummy. It has a tendency to gall, wear, erode out of tolerance much quicker than high carbon tool steel. So we'll make that point also up front. Now, I might top all of the development thus far in the long-range big bore sniper system centered around the Wildcat 375 improved Magnum cartridge by saying that most any existing available sporter rifle, commonly referred to as Safari grade sporter rifle, currently chambered for the 375 H&H Magnum round, has the capability of relatively easily, in competent hands and in a competently equipped machine shop, gunsmithing shop, has the ready ability to be converted to the improved Magnum round easily.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, chambering reamer, again, in the proper machine tooling setup and in proper hands, the reaming operation and head spacing is
not an unusual operation.
It's not at all an unusual operation, and there's really no further attenuating modifications necessary to accommodate the improved round. And we had a question come in, and I'll just kind of field these in the course of the subject matter being covered right now. Someone phoned in during or between the hours after the previous 6 to 7 hour our time with the question, is this the Ackley improved round? And yes, it is. Actually, the 375 improved mag round is, in fact, the original P.O. Ackley designed cartridge. Another question ran along the lines of how does the 375 improved Magnum compare to the 378 Weatherby mag cartridge? Frankly, ballistically, it is a little bit lighter, to the tune of per equal bullet weight, roughly 150 feet per second, lower muzzle velocity than the 378 Weatherby Magnum cartridge in a standard 24-inch typical Magnum barrel. However, when chambered in the barrel length normally used for the long-range rifle project, which is 28 inches, the performance of the two rounds, both the Wildcat as well as the 378 Weatherby Magnum, are virtually identical or close enough for, shall we say, government work. In other words, within 50 feet a second. And the reason for that is the additional 4 inches of barrel length in the long-range rifle project makes up the difference and boosts that amount of additional velocity. Now, I might also add that the reason in the original research project that the 378 Weatherby was not selected to build the rifle around was simply the fact that the 378 components, that is to say cases, are virtually like hen's teeth. As a matter of fact, as far as availability, also with regard to cost, from the standpoint that there is only one manufacturer or extruder of 378 Weatherby Magnum brass or cartridge casings, and that is Norma. And Norma actually produces the 378 casing in their artillery division, not in their small arms ammunition division. And so, therefore, you're extremely limited with regard to availability on that primary component. Without it, you're dead in the water. Also, I might add, for those not at all familiar, the fact that the 378 Weatherby it shares no head dimensions specifically as it relates to the overall case dimensions with any other belted magnum casing on the market. Whereas you see the 375 Improved has a commonality with all other belted magnum cases from 22 caliber magnums clear on up to 458 Winchester.
And we've already established that the 375 H&H Magnum round is readily available and is not in short supply. And you're going to manufacture the improved case yourself when you fire this 375 H&H Magnum in the modified chamber of your new barrel, your new action, and it's going to come out as the new casing, which you're going to then reload, and that's how you obtain the 375 H&H Magnum Improved. So the barrel we've established, as far as your preference goes, is the high carbon steel chrome alloyed 28-inch barrel, and of course with the modified chamber, which can be done by any competent machine shop or gunsmith.
Correct. Yeah, Bill, that's absolutely correct. So that covers a couple of very, very valid and astute questions that were phoned in, during the couple-hour break there between shows. And another question was, did we pick the Mauser action only for the extraction or extractor reliability? Apparently they weren't listening or didn't copy the entire previous transmission from the standpoint that, no, the other factor was the fact that the typical Mauser is a forging or forged machining in addition to the attributes of this extraction system. The question, will any Model 98 Mauser work, such as a World War II? Here again, someone I don't think quite listening, although the question would normally otherwise be valid. Yes, there's almost, with the exception of perhaps two Arsenal origin manufacturers, almost any vintage surplus large ring Mauser action will work for this purpose. And then a question regarding the Seiko Model TRG-S action. Apparently this caller was advised that it was better than a Mauser. And then I can't read the rest of it quite. But anyway, no, again, the weak point there is a serious compromise in the extraction system. I can't put it any more simply than that. What we're doing is we're hitting the high points with reference to durability, reliability, and then, of course, accuracy potential. And we find that all of those attributes are found in the age-old Mauser system, dating back into the 19th century. Now, what I'd like to do from this point is proceed on into what can be done to maximize the performance of all those privately held turn bolts out there in gun racks and closets and pickup cab racks and whatnot currently, to make those commonly chambered weapons perform to maximum ranges with maximum hit predictability or probability. And first, right off the bat, and this is without regard to manufacturer or origin of, I don't care if it's a Ruger Model 77 or the Remington 700, as I mentioned, fine accuracy potential in that action right off the bat, or your Winchester Model 670 or what have you. Without exception, there's not a single one of those out of the box, off the rack, brand new production rifles whereby their capability cannot be increased by 100% right up front with one very simple operation if it's done properly.
And it just happens to be the next operation that would be performed after the mating of the action in the barrel on the long-range rifle that we're building.
Coincidentally, that's the case. And that operation is known very simply, and it is an accurizing operation, as glass bedding or micro bedding and barrel floating. Now, when I make the qualification done properly, what I need to stress or emphasize here is that if you're requesting this operation be done by a local smith in your area, you must normally specify to him that you and describe verbally or even with a drawing if necessary or by demonstration that you intend for him to fiberglass bed the entire action channel from the very rearmost tip of the tang forward to mid-chamber. Thoroughly bed the entire action channel. Most often, the average tradesman or smith will very much like factories today consider a bedding job to be a glob of glass daubed into the recoil lug recess, inletted in your typical wood or synthetic stock, and consider that a bedding job. And it is not. What you're endeavoring to achieve here is precise micro support of that entire receiver from the very rear of the tang, that is behind the trigger plate and trigger group, clear forward to midway chamber. Then, where the glass ends at mid-chamber forward of that, throughout the barrel channel, forward through the fore-end, or what's known as the forewood, that area must be channeled out, or slang terms, what we call hogged out, to accommodate an absolute air clearance, allowing, in the case of wood stocks, by the way, for expansion, contraction, and distortion due to humidity and atmosphere and wet weather, whereby the wood would be expected to swell and distort.
Mm-hmm.
You have to channel out to such an extent that you maintain an absolutely air gauge, or that is to say, absence of wood to metal contact from that glass bedding forward.
Actually, from the glass bedding forward, mid-chamber forward, you don't ever want anything to touch the barrel.
That's right.
Including a bipod.
Correct.
And we'll get into that later, but I just want to make that point.
Now, having done that, what I meant by 100% improvement in accuracy potential literally means this. You take the typical, let's say, M77 Ruger, for sake of example, with a capability, let's say, in the 30-06 chambering of typically holding a 1 1/8 inch group at 100 yards, which would just be a hair over what we call minute of angle accuracy. And by the way, we're speaking in terms of 5-round successive groups. And it will literally, that one action or one operation having been completed alone, reduce that group size or group diameter by 50%. So that means that you'll instantly be in the 5/8 to 3/4 of an inch maximum center to center group dimension.
And that's quite an improvement with just one operation.
Simple to perform operation, and usually relatively inexpensive. I'd have to take a market average. Don't hold me to this, but a good guideline or rule of thumb nationally is probably going to be under $75. For that one.
Mm-hmm.
And again, having completed that, I can't stress it enough. That single operation is at the top of the priority list for as it regards dramatic impact on your resulting performance. Now, operation number two, believe it or not, has absolutely nothing to do with physical modifications to the weapon itself. We want to focus at this point on the capability to hand load. In other words, is the owner shooter's capability to roll his own ammunition. Having that capability, and incidentally most folks today relate to that capability as it regards expense or economy in shooting, or stockpiling, or whatever it is they might have in mind. Frankly, that attribute of reloading is quite a ways down the priority list. The emphasis here should be placed on the fact that once appraised of the procedure, the shooter has the capability of scientifically developing a load matched to that specific rifle. For this, I should use as an example the fact that there are no two, for example, Remington 700 rifles, same chambering, that are identically the same. They're a machine tool product. And a machine tool product is like fingerprint. That's why various law enforcement agencies have traditionally, in the modern age, certainly throughout the 20th century, utilized rifling striations as an identifying ballistic factor for recovered bullets from torsos and et cetera, cadavers. For the same reason, you will find that, again, being a machine tool product, that no two rifles, although the same model, virtually identical in appearance, and being of the same caliber or chambering, are going to perform exactly the same with the same load. So, therefore, the hand loader has the option and the capability of developing a load for his individual rifle that will perform to an optimum goal usually previously set. If by golly, if all things are equal, all conditions are tip-top mechanically in that rifle, otherwise, no reason to expect that if he sets a goal as a half minute of angle group that it won't be achieved if he simply applies enough patience at the loading bench. And point number three, with regard to the home processed, or shall we say recycled sporting rifle, crowning, that is, close attention being paid to the way the rifle's muzzle is finished off, is critical. Not quite as romantic from the standpoint that it will never produce the dramatic results that bedding and floating, nor that hand loading will produce as far as consistency or repeatability improvements in a rifle, but certainly generally beneficial. Target recrowning of the typical muzzle will produce very positive results, usually in the neighborhood of 20 to 25% group diameter reduction. And I might add that if done to specification, and that is a what we call square cut target recess crown, you have a resulting crown that will protect the very highly critical, from an accuracy standpoint, chamfer on the barrel's bore, meaning that impacts, by rocks and whatnot to the barrel's muzzle will generally avoid any critical accuracy destroying damage to that highly critical chamfer at the muzzle. And fourthly, an operation that is more of a custom personal type item would be a trigger job, that is competent trigger work on the trigger group to establish a release or what's known as let off, striker let off, established at a weight that is manageable for the individual and preferable for the conditions in which the rifle is to be applied. Now, I'll have to say this, the average sporter found on a deer trip in the field, really not desirable to have anything much below a 2¾-pound or 44-ounce typical trigger release on that rifle from several standpoints. You get much below that, down around 2 pounds, you're developing a risky trigger pull, one in which safety is not a factor that can be totally controlled.
Don't go away, folks. We've got to take a short break. Be right back after this pause. Well, folks, we've only got half of the last hour of this two-hour series to go. So I'm going to trust you to do what you know that you need to do. That's take care to protect everything you've worked for all your life up to this point and make sure that the financial future of your family, your loved ones, is assured against what we all know is coming. So call Swiss America Trading right now. Mention my name, William Cooper. Ask for all the free reading material that you're entitled to as listeners to the Hour of the Time. Thank them for sponsoring this program and ask them to help you set up some kind of an investment plan in non-confiscatable, non-reportable hard assets. The only thing that's ever protected anyone in the history of the world that has not lost any value and still maintains the same value that it had 300 years ago, and that's gold, silver, platinum, in its various forms. So call now 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Gene Miller will be here tomorrow night with our normal Monday metal report. We didn't want to take time out from this broadcast to do it. So call now, 1-800-289-2646, and you'll be glad that you did. For those of you who may have missed the first hour earlier this evening, you may order tapes of the Hour of the Time. Specify the date and the subject. You must specify both the date and the subject, and you must state early or late or both. Now make sure that you do that, because if you don't, we're going to send you the tape that we think you want, and it may not be the one that you actually want. If you're not a CADGI member, tapes are $8, $8 per hour. If you are a CADGI member, then you know that tapes are $6. Prices are post-paid, which means you don't have to send anything extra for postage or handling. Send to William Cooper, P.O. Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. That's P.O. Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. John, let's continue. We got a lot to talk about and just a little bit of time to do it in.
I'll expand a little bit further, Bill, on the trigger job project or specification. As it should be stated to the practitioner or tradesman in your local area, I would recommend asking the competent individual to establish a let off or release at right at 44 ounces, 2¾ pounds. We found that overall for general long range target work, about the most manageable, predictable trigger available and consistent. Round to round consistency here is just as important as that 1/10 grain or less tolerance or allowable deviance in your powder charge. Just as important. At the same time, specify the elimination or total absence of any pre-travel slack in the trigger, and to minimize any over-travel, which is, of course, that amount of trigger arc remaining after the release, which is also a distraction. Having done that, and combining all four of these operations, even though one is not directly, and that's being the hand-loading operation, not being directly related to modifications to a weapon per se, adding all of these together, which I've just done during the break, I'd say that on average across the country, this package, we'll call it, combined cost-wise, would amount to probably $450. However, the results produced by this package would exceed using other approaches what you could very easily spend in excess of $1,000 to achieve.
Well, let's give them an example with the building the long-range rifle that we're talking about building. I already have approximately $800 into it, and I have just ordered the InterArms Mark 10 375 H&H Magnum Whitworth rifle and the scope. And we'll talk about scopes a little bit later if we have time. Well, we've got to make time. But by the time all the modifications are done that I need done to this rifle to give me the ultimate sniper rifle that I want, and bear in mind, folks, this is not an assault rifle. This is a sniper rifle. It's a specialized rifle for one thing only, hitting a target at an extremely long range and doing it accurately, consistently. So I estimate that I'll probably have $1,400 or $1,500 into this rifle when I'm finished, and could possibly be more.
That would be a very close assessment. Let's give it a range of $1,450 to $1,600,
okay.
Reality-wise.
Now, compare that to what you're talking, $450, $475 to make improvements on what they already have rather than starting from scratch and building a new rifle. That's quite a difference in money output.
Yes, it is. And actually, other than the sheer ballistic considerations and attenuating capabilities to the much heavier 375 cartridge, anything typically within the 30 caliber, both standard, and I'm going to take in 7.62 NATO now, 308 commercially, 30-06, any one of the four typical standard 300 Magnum family inclusive, amongst any of those choices that I think we're going to find tons of out there already in issue amongst the populace. All of which, having made these previous modifications that I just described and enumerated, would give you the capability very easily of operational range between 5 and 750 yards, you know, with, I think, very little disappointment.
And that's right in the ballpark for our demand, which is to, we've got to be able to hit the enemy 500 yards and out. The farther out, the better. All battered armies are trained to be effective and fight within 200 yards of whoever they're fighting. And if you can keep them at that distance, or if you can hit your target at that distance, they're literally going to be at a great disadvantage, and we need every advantage that we can get. So that's good. You're telling them that with what they have, performing these basic modifications or adjustments, as the case may be, that they're going to be able to get out to that distance.
That's correct, Bill.
Now, with the rifle that we're building, what are we talking about?
let's qualify that. You mean in terms of cost?
No, I mean in terms of let's talk about cost, and then let's talk about range.
Well, let's say, which is not the case, so we're being academic here largely, but let's say that all components necessary to assemble or construct the long-range system that we started the first hour going into some detail in description of were all available, which they're not. So that right there is a major insurpassable obstruction at the moment. If all those things were present, the components were available, you'd be talking cost-wise in the neighborhood typically of $3,800 to complete that project. Now, that would include everything, the custom dies, a start on some of the ammunition components, all set up and shipped in a hard case, and that's nice. But unfortunately, that discussion is largely academic because of diminishing and unavailable supply. But by comparison, there you would have a weapon that, very practically expectations of 1 mile or 1,760 yards is not too much to expect out of the system.
Not only not too much, but has been done. The rifle's been built. It has been done. It has been proven. And the reason we're doing this program tonight is because you can't order that rifle now because, as John has stated, you cannot get the parts that you need he can't build it. Nobody can build it now because the parts aren't there. But you can build your own following the instructions we gave during the first hour of the time and the instructions that we're giving you during this hour of the time. And you can also, if you choose not to go that route, it would also be cheaper, by the way, but if you choose not to go that route, you can, of course, modify your existing weapon with the lower cost and still have something that can reach out to 600-700 yards, maybe even 800 yards if you've got some good equipment and you're a good shot. Everything depends upon you ultimately.
Fire discipline can't be stressed enough, and in this day of diminishing supply in reloading components alone, powder, the growing inavailability or progressive inavailability in primers and other essentials, practices becoming more at a premium all the time, but is no less necessary than the heyday of the shooting industry, say through the 70s and pretty much clear through the 80s, whereby all that material was commonly available. And average shooting day back during those conditions should have averaged no less than 200-300 long-range rounds concentrated in fire. Well, we still need to try to approximate that kind of work on the range, live fire, because there is no substitute for live fire training and live fire discipline.
That's true.
But in the meantime, I will say, just as a guideline or rule of thumb, that if your goal, which it should be, or your expectation for your own present equipment now, if your mode seems to be, shall we say, improvement of present equipment, is a goal of effective, predictable hit probability at 500 yards and beyond, bear in mind that there's not much use, really, or sense, practical sense, in attempting ranges out there and beyond until you have a rifle that will hold at least half minute of angle, and that is the equivalent of 1/2 inch groups. Practically, when you're dealing with 30 caliber rounds, for example, is just 1/2 inch diameter ragged hole containing 5 rounds at 100 yards. So whatever work is powder, time and effort beyond that range.
Of course. Now let's go back to, since we've covered this now, let's go back to the original rifle that we began building during the first hour, and we wanted to get this in, how to improve what you've already got in case you can't do this or can't find the components. We've got the receiver, we've got the barrel, we know what those are, we know how to make our improved round. Now we're going to need reloading dies. Where do they get them?
Well, Bill, dies are still a product, machine tool product, that is, to my knowledge today, currently still fairly readily available.
Okay, are they available for the 375 H&H improved magnum?
Yes, they are. In fact, they're even a listed, what they call number. It's in a Class D or Column D category with Huntington dies, which generally they do their supply through RCBS.
Mm-hmm.
So either of those two sources, you'd have a Class D die set, which is in the higher price category. Last time I paid much attention to it, was somewhere between $80 and $100, you know, per set. But they're considered to be a stock item, not special order.
Okay, good.
So as far as time lag or expected delivery interval, not too distant on that. Usually a couple of weeks.
Okay, now, you've specified how the stock has to be mated with the action in the barrel, and that the action has to be glass bedded, and of course the barrel floated from mid. Putting something on the barrel. I know the answer to that, but you know what I'm leading up to, so that we can explain to the people who are listening.
Yes, Bill, you'd be referring to your typical built-in rifle. Assault weapons, so-called, and whatnot, RPK variants and whatnot, where you find bipods permanent. Bipod should be attached or affixed to the stock. Principle behind the flotation job done through the barrel channel of the stock is to relieve any outside applied stress whatsoever on that barrel. And in doing so, again, you protect the potential, full potential, of that barrel action's capability. So, therefore, contact of a support mechanism, such as a bipod, for that matter, when you're on the range bench, what we call bench resting or sandbagging the rifle for accuracy at a measured range, resting the rifle on its barrel on the sandbag should be avoided, or the machine rest or whatever device is being used for bench support. Same principle applies to that bipod. It must be fore-end mounted on the stock, avoiding any contact or weight bearing on the barrel whatsoever.
Now let's get on to one other thing that you surprised me with today when we were discussing this, and that's a compensator. Number one, you don't normally see a compensator on a rifle. You may see a flash suppressor, but what you've done is sort of incorporate both into one. And this compensator gave you an added benefit that I certainly didn't expect, and you didn't expect to find either until you ran the tests, actually, on the performance of the rifle. And can you tell us about that?
Yes, sir. Your muzzle brake system, of course, is actually not. powered or center fire cartridge weapon. Of a typical shoulder arm. Now, as a side benefit, as Bill mentioned, it's been discovered that a little extra boost is generally gained in that average anywhere from 1.5 inch length muzzle brake device to, in the case of the big calibers, clear up to 3.5 inch net gain over the net barrel length. A boost is enjoyed in muzzle velocity, and that's in defiance to typical physical logic in that, well, we won't get all off into complex
we don't have time.
details on that, but it does just suffice it to say it's an actual boost in velocity, usually on an average around 50 feet per second by virtue of the installed muzzle brake device.
Okay, now you also recommend that there's some kind of padding on the butt of the stock, and in our case, we decided to go with what Packmire calls a decelerator, and that should attenuate the recoil quite a bit and make it much more comfortable to fire this weapon repeatedly. But the compensator takes an awful lot out of what's normally called a kick.
Right.
And in fact, it takes so much of the energy that would normally be applied to the kick and puts it on the bipod that the bipod is actually driven into the ground.
Again, the direct opposite and equal reaction due to gas thrust and the use of the gas diversion device or muzzle brake. That's right. Out about it.
And this is energy that normally would be transferred
or inventing is that you can expect by gauging such variables as port diameter and number of ports and length of expansion chamber and etc., all internal features of the device, you can achieve very easily neutral muzzle climb. That is to say, even when fired from standing offhand position, there is absolutely no vertical upward movement of the barrel whatsoever. Secondly, a measurable 30% reduction of felt recoil at the shoulder. So you're actually dealing with a combination of two factors directly and dramatically affected by the installation of such a design.
Wow. So one other thing, I want you to cover it real quickly, because then I want you to give the energy that this weapon can produce and the velocity, and that's the scope.
Well, optics, Bill, are a primary factor in long range aspirations of any shooter. Very highly critical. They're also one of the most elusive butterflies as far as trying to mate the correct instrument with the right job. Frankly, personally, I've never been a fan at all of so-called variable power scopes, simply because even in their highest quality, highest cost variants, there's no escape from what is known as parallax distortion at one end of the adjustable power range or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that parallax distortion literally translates into an alteration of impact point as zeroed on a particular power. So that's a convoluted way of trying to say that as you adjust progressively up or down through the powers, when zeroed at a given range on
that's the only place you're zeroed.
That's right.
Okay.
And it does literally alter your point of impact as you vary those powers.
Uh-huh.
So I'd have to say, as again a general rule of thumb, I'd try wherever possible and wherever suitable with regard to appropriate magnification for a given expected range of operation. I would try to select the appropriate
and you'll have to get the brand to suit yourself, and you have to remember that to hit something at 1,000 yards or greater, it's going to have a good magnification, because at that distance, most people can't even see a man. So bear that in mind, folks, and remember optics are important. Now let's get to the specs of the performance of this weapon. What will it do? And I'm talking about the one that we've been building tonight, not what people can improve, and certainly not the weapon that you originally built that we cannot duplicate at this time. But what will this weapon that we've just built tonight, what will it do? What are the specs?
Referring back to the 375 improved Magnum,
right,
delivers a muzzle velocity at, and this is over a chronograph placed, a chronograph, by the way, is an electronic velocity measuring device placed 15 yards forward of the muzzle. Projectile being fired through it, 270 grain projectile at a muzzle velocity of 3,050 feet a second. That actually equates to the neighborhood of 7,200 foot-pounds of energy, or you're approaching 4 ton. All of which are dramatic, impressive, you know, figures when compared to, let's say, the typical 308 or 7.62 NATO round fired from a typical average 20-inch barrel, delivering around 2,800 foot-pounds of energy.
How about velocity?
And likewise, 2,650 feet per second, 2,650 feet a second on the 308. Yes.
And on the 357 H&H Mag improved?
375 H&H Mag. Muzzle velocity, I think I mentioned, was 3,050 feet per second.
Okay, how about the foot-pounds?
7,200.
7,200 foot-pounds. So that translates at 1,000 yards with this weapon, still having the force of being hit just a few feet in front with a 44 Magnum.
That's correct. At 1,000 yards, that would translate to either a typical 44 Magnum load or a little Russian short fired from an SKS right at the muzzle.
So, folks, there you have it. The ultimate one-man arsenal in a war that we want to avoid but might be inevitable. Good night, and God bless you all.